Everyone, welcome to the Corn and Turner podcast. We have a very interesting, different kind of an episode today. I have Tiffany Boyd here with me, and we will be having Connie Reguli zooming in with us. And we are going to do a review. Chase from Patriot Punk, who has been on the show before as well. I've been on his, so you may remember him. He did a taping of the Professional Educators of Tennessee's call with Cameron Sexton, Haston, and who's the other one?
J.C. Bowman, I believe.
J.C. Bowman. Uh-huh. So we're going to listen to some of the clips from that call, and we're going to have a little conversation about it. And this is regarding the Education Freedom Scholarship Act that we've been covering for quite a bit on this show. So those who aren't familiar, this is around the school choice topic. So before we start, I'll just say, if you like what we're doing here, please support the podcast. You can like, share, subscribe. You can also go to the website or just click the links below and either send me a gifts and go, a Venmo, a buy me a coffee, or you can send me something to my PO box, or you can find products down below and help support the podcast that way as well. I do want to also remind you that for just 1 week, we will be having a $150 discount on the Relax Saunas. So definitely take an opportunity to get a discount on that. And thank you so much for being here. And we'll have Connie zooming in with us as well. So I have not listened to this full call. I've heard some of the clips that we pulled, but you did, yes. And Connie did. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it should be interesting. I can't wait to go into some discussions about certain topics that were covered in that particular call.
Yes, likewise.
I have said, I've weighed in on this already on my personal page, and I said, in my opinion, this is the encapsulation of backroom deals where things are discussed and bills are filled with pork in an attempt to get them to pass through and be written into law.
Well, that's certainly what it looks like when I just being privy to some of the meetings. Mm-hmm. So I guess let's start with, we'll bring Connie in first. Hey, Connie, how are you doing?
Hello, ladies. So good to see you.
Hello.
You too. So you had a chance to listen to it as well.
I did. And Tiffany and I've had several conversations, and I'm not the education expert. She is, but I am, as it relates to DCS and all the crazy stuff they're doing with juveniles and undocumented children. So, it all plays into the same theme.
Yeah.
All right. So do you have anything else you want to say about it before people listen to the clips?
No, I did listen to it. I'll tell you my overall perspective or perception is the people on the call, because there's some discussion on the call with the lawmakers, and then the lawmakers hang up. And I found the discussion after the lawmakers hang up was very interesting, because I don't know if we're going to play this clip, but they're really kind of talking about how they have secured the votes to pass this bill, and how in Texas, when they didn't pass the bill, people got replaced. And so a lot of the maneuvering, not just the contents of the bill and how it's going to affect family and children, after the legislators hang up, there's some very interesting conversation about how they're going to make this happen, regardless of whether or not it's a good public policy. So for people, I hope you will put the link in there so people can jump over there and watch the whole thing if they want to. I think they'll find it.
Definitely. I definitely encourage people to go. We'll post the link below and you can watch the whole thing for yourself. It does seem like they're very determined to just push this through by any means. Mm-hmm. And there must be reasons for that. So, all right. Well, let's pull up the first one.
That money can only take us so far. And so there's other things that we think we can do to help teachers in the classroom. And we'll talk about that through the choice bill, because it's not just about choice, as you said, it's about other things.
Yes. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting, because this has been sold as a school choice bill.
Right.
But this particular version that we're discussing here is the House amendment, which is 1183. And that is the bill that's filled full of all of the pork and all of the additional things. So in this phone call, they're discussing, I believe it was a 37, 38, 39 page amendment. I don't know how many pages it's up to right now, but you're going to see just a small portion of school choice. And what we're really going to be spending our time talking about are all the other things that have been added in.
Well, and I think the public needs to remember that there's a, you know, a lot of the homeschool parents and the parents who want to really be free of the government to educate their children is kind of one end of the spectrum. And the other end of the spectrum is the, you know, sort of the public educators unions and the public educators consideration of their domain of education. And those are very powerful lobbies, and there are people with a lot of money, and there are people who get up there and walk the halls and don't stop talking. And so they've got to do something. And I'm going to throw this in there. This is a bit of a diversion, but the same thing is kind of happening in another committee about what they call, they're trying to label it a parental rights bill, but it's really, it's family rights and responsibilities bill. And it's actually, they're just giving it a funny name and trying to sell it as something, and it's really something else.
Interesting. I actually haven't followed that bill. I don't know what that one's all about.
That's the bill that we referred to in the show that you and I did not long ago. And I said there was a petition circulating that Connie had created. That was that particular parental rights bill.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And I did, I went and spoke on that, and I did clip that section of the hearing and put it up on my YouTube channel too. So you can scoot over there when you have a chance and look at it, because I talk about, it's really a government control bill, but not to be, there it is. Bless your heart.
Yeah, there it is.
No. I remember this bill now. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it seems to be a common theme all around. What are some of the, but we don't want to take too long on each one, but I am curious, what are some of the other like key things that are wrapping into this bill that's not just school choice?
Yeah. I think as we go through this call, we're going to be picking out, some of those points. But Connie is right. They knew, they're trying to garner as much support as possible from as many people as possible with this piece of legislation. So my takeaway from this is they're trying to almost placate the public school teachers and the public school leadership into believing that this bill is really going to be good for them. Even though I'm like Connie, the very interesting part, in my opinion, the really interesting part of this was after our legislators left the call and they were having a discussion, because my opinion was that the teachers weren't buying it. Like they weren't fully buying what they were being sold, you know, by these lawmakers. So, but I do believe that that's the reason why so much was added to this bill, is because they were trying to make it as attractive as possible to as many people as possible. So hopefully those that would have been opposed to it in the past, you know, like the Democrats, for example, they are fundamentally opposed to school choice, because they feel like it destroys public education. So they were wise in what they have tried to craft here, thinking, well, if we fill this full of things that are good for public education, then the Democrats would get on board and vote for this. So there's a lot of money involved in this, so they're doing whatever they can do to get this passed.
All right. Do you have anything else you want to add to that, Connie?
No. She's right.
We'll go on.
Absentee is one issue that we're trying to work on in the bill as well, which may impact you, may not impact you, but we're trying to do a workaround on that.
A workaround?
What does that mean? That's a good question. Chronic absenteeism. So Freer Children was opposed to HB 1214 back during the last legislative session, where they were wanting to open at-risk boarding charter facilities. And those facilities had criteria for how they were going to identify at-risk children. And one of those pieces of criteria was chronic absenteeism. So that is embedded in this pork-filled bill, how they are going to identify, how they are going to intervene. So there are interventions. We don't know what those interventions are going to be, but they definitely mention interventions in this bill as well, which is concerning to me on multiple levels.
Yeah.
Considering the fact that we were fighting at-risk boarding charter facilities last legislative session, and Connie and I were talking about this earlier, that hasn't gone away. People think it's gone away. Weigh in on that, Connie.
Yeah, no, and I'll tell you, and I think this is probably where Tiffany and I's paths crossed last year, because I have been about parental rights, protecting families through the court system, trying to keep families stabilized, if at all possible, out of DCS control. And this bill 1214 popped up last year, and it was a very long bill too. I mean, it was probably 14-15 pages, and on buried there in about page 4 or 5, somewhere in there, it talked about these boarding schools, which were for at-risk students. And she's right, they talk about chronic absenteeism. They also talk about dysfunctional families. I mean, and it's just that vague. It's like, if a family is dysfunctional, they can take your child.
Do they have a model of who the functional family is?
That's exactly right.
And I'll tell you, court systems and even our General Assembly, you know, you know, a bell curve goes like this, right? And as far as the General Assembly is concerned, if you don't fit into that top tier of the bell curve where they think you should be, you're a dysfunctional family. They're very unforgiving of just, you know, the struggles that people are going through. And so I am very suspicious that the at-risk boarding school that was in 1214 is in 1183, period. I think it's in there.
Yeah, I've said that too. I said that it would likely pop up, and I spoke to other people that were fundamentally involved with that bill last year. Right. And we all had the same takeaway as Connie, that it didn't go away and that it will reappear at some point in the near future somewhere. And that has been my fear with this particularly large school choice bill that the House is peddling all along. So I agree with that.
Well, and they're just sneaking it in there. They're just reforming it. You know, it's a little piece of Play-Doh. They're just, they rolled it up in their hands. They squished it, flattened it out a little bit, put a different name on it. And now they're going to put it in, they're going to put it back in here, because we know they want more government control over our kids, no matter how you look at it.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, that is very concerning. It does look like they're trying to find a way that they can swoop in and take control of the children, separate them from their parents.
Yeah.
So, all right. Next.
Require on the House version that they have to take the state assessment or a nationally recognized assessment for those kids who are using the scholarship. Not all kids in private school, obviously, but if you're using a scholarship and you're going to a private school, you have to take one of those assessments. A lot of private schools are probably already doing some form of national assessment, whether it's a Stanford or Iowa or something. And so that information for that student will get reported back to the state through a third party where we can monitor the progress.
Keywords there, where we can monitor the progress.
Right. Absolutely. And I have lots of questions. Who's the third party vendor? You know, number one.
Did they say?
No, I've asked that question and no one has been able to answer that regarding who that third party vendor is.
Right.
And then we know that FERPA, you know, allows them to disseminate information, private information that you know they have harvested to any entity in the name of educational research without parental consent. So we have no way of knowing where the data is going, not just to the Department of Education, because in the Senate hearing, committee hearing where I participated, you know, I was there both times, it's been through the committee in the Senate. And Senator Lundberg kept saying over and over again, we need to collect as much data as possible.
Right.
And then, you know, in other committees, they have said, you know, it's going to go over to the Department of Education for them to do with as they see fit.
Right.
So, you know, that could mean anything.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's important to point out that parents have been told that this doesn't come with strings. Does that sound like strings to you?
Yeah, they definitely sound. And it sounds like strings that haven't even been tightened yet.
Right, exactly.
It sounds like they're just laying a couple of strings that have some very sticky, tacky glue on them.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note this, too, that they're saying that if a child at a private school accepts this voucher money, yeah. they're required to do this testing. Yeah. The rest of the school may not be required to do that testing. Well, in order to do well on any type of test, you have to have material that's teaching to that
yeah,
test.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. I was just thinking, so who do we know what's on those tests?
Right.
And what's to say they won't change what's on those
right.
tests?
Right. I mean, the child,
the child's study to pass the test.
Exactly. The child's curriculum is going to have to be aligned to whatever test that they're taking.
So if they want to teach CRT, Common Core, whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, and it's not just, you know, Common Core and CRT. It's also just the, even in the standard subjects. It's like if you're doing a homeschool and, you know, you have a child that's, you know, just not really going to tie themselves into advanced math, you know, they may be more interested in history. And, you know, if the point is that you should be able to educate your child on, you know, give them the basics in math so that they can operate and function in society, but maybe they, you know, they're so much better in another subject. So when we get back to the standardized testing, and again, it gets into the, you know, the bell curve. And so you got to fit within this parameter of the bell curve in every area. Yeah, and that's just not how humans are made, you know. I mean, just look around at us as adults. I mean, there are some things I do super really, really well at. You know, I was doing a live today and I said, you know, some old people have to get their newspaper every day. I have to have LexisNexis. I'm like, you know, like somebody, something comes up in the news and I have to go like look up the legal thing. That's just me. But, you know, I mean, I can barely balance my checkbook. I mean, that's just the truth. So what are we creating here? We're back to that place where we're trying to standardize, right? It's trying to standardize, which is not what, you know, personal education is about.
Right. I would take it a step further because with these standardized tests, you know, even within these different subjects, they're teaching them how to take a very specific test. They're not teaching them the subject.
Right.
They're not teaching them how that would be applicable, you know, in life. They're teaching them to pass a very specific type of test. So I've always personally just had trouble with that. Like I don't think that that's very productive in the grand scheme of, you know, what education should theoretically prepare you to do.
Yeah. And then the state is setting the benchmarks for success. It's no longer the parents that are deciding if that student is successful in whatever they're being taught. It would then be the state setting those benchmarks for the kids.
Right. Yeah. All right, Nick.
And I, you know, and I just want to say, I think there are parents out there that have their kids in public school, and even if they're not the most involved parents, I mean, you have a sense about your child, even in the public school system, as to kind of what they're better at, you know, like, and when you see, and I can say this, you know, I'm saying this from a couple different worlds of experience, and partly because I still have two grandchildren in the public school system who are totally different. And one of them is just the whiz kid in so many things. And the other one, she's a beautiful, great person, but the academic stuff is very, very, it's a strain for her. It's just not where she is. And, but what they're able to do is they are able to take her and specifically train her to do okay in that testing scenario. Right. So, I mean, she walks away from it and 5 months, 5 minutes later, she didn't really know what it is, but you know, the whole testing thing, you know, we're, it's just, especially the standardized now, you know, if you study a subject in history and then, you know, a parent, a homeschooling parent wants to practice and study and do some testing in that area just to test your memory, that's totally different than when you're trying to standardize and equalize children in everything,
Sure. Absolutely. My experience from being a public school teacher, you know, because prior to homeschooling, I was a tenured public school teacher when I resigned. And the trend in education has always been too much, too soon and too fast.
Right.
So most of these children are being expected and required to do things that are not developmentally appropriate in the first place.
Right.
And then when they can't meet those requirements, they're automatically labeled as behind or not as intelligent or, you know, needing remedial services or being identified as at risk. And there's nothing wrong with those children.
Right.
They're just being children. They are just not developmentally at the point the state says they should be by third grade. You see what I'm saying? Every child, like Connie pointed out, they're an individual. So math skills, more advanced math skills, may not come to that child until they're older.
Right.
That doesn't mean there have been lots of professionals who have written and studied and really delved really deeply into this subject. There are some kids that don't read until they're 11 years old, and there's nothing wrong with them. They just were not ready to take that step developmentally. And I think, you know, anytime, like Connie said, when you start talking about standardized achievements, it's a norm reference and it's not even developmentally appropriate oftentimes.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a very valid point. Mm-hmm. And it also doesn't give, as you were saying, honey, it doesn't give them the individual the opportunity to excel in areas they may be gifted.
Right.
Because they're being dragged down. I always, I'll share this, you know, I was a coach, a trainer, a CrossFit coach, and, you know, they always say, work your weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And I would always say, no, work your strengths. And, you know, and this is kind of what it reminds me of, because if everybody's so busy being bogged down by the things that they're weak at.
Exactly.
And I don't think you neglect your weaknesses because they can hold back your strength, but they're most likely your weaknesses are not going to become your strengths.
Right.
But your strengths are your unique gifts and talents. And, you know, I believe that we were all given those so that we could harness them and develop them and hone them so we can be a contribution to the world. Mm-hmm. So if we're so busy being bogged down with the weaknesses, we don't have an opportunity to develop the strengths and the gifts. So.
Absolutely. Weaknesses are also worth a lot of money to the state, because then when they start diagnosing children as at risk and having all these issues, then they can, you know, bill Medicaid.
This is true.
Yep.
All right. Next.
We have a couple of friends I know that are leaving the profession because they're tired of all these IPGs, and they are highly, they're fours and fives on their scores. So they're just tired of being observed.
Yeah, and the thing is, as we move forward, I mean, with the caption of the bill that we have is open to education as a whole. So it's relative to education.
IPGs, sorry, I'm not familiar.
Yeah, what they're talking about are all these assessments that the teachers are faced with today. So I think that they thought they could make this attractive to the teachers by making the evaluations not as frequent, you know, by eliminating some of these evaluations for the teachers that are in the profession and that are dealing with this. But I think I found it very interesting, two things. First, I found it very interesting that you want to eliminate the evaluations. So that would be less accountability for teachers, but more accountability for students via these standardized tests. So that struck me as interesting. And then when he says that this bill opens up the entire education code, and I want Connie to weigh in on that, because that literally means anything having to do with education. And they have the ability to come in there and make changes, because they did open up the entire Tennessee Code Annotated Chapter 49 Education Code.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, I'll tell you, as an attorney who's had her nose buried in those green books for 30 years, you know, they go in every year, and I don't even think all the General Assembly members, I mean, they don't even know what's in all those books. And when I do my speeches down there and I talk to them, that's one of the things I preempt my speech with. It's like, for 30 years, I've had my nose buried in that green book, and I've seen what's happened year after year, which, again, you know, back to that parental rights bill, which is not parental rights. They're creating a new code, and they're creating a whole new code. And they've got, parents have all these rights, except for this, except for this, except for this, unless this, unless this, does not apply here, does not apply there. So, and there's all these, there's gotchas in there, right? So what will happen is, you know, they may try to make it as innocuous as they can at some point and try to water some things down. And then they go in year after year and they just take one little section. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they'll add a sentence or they'll change the language. And these bills are very hard to read because it'll say delete section so-and-so and add section so-and-so. Now, I will tell you that I'm not sure if it passed, but there's a bill where it says that when they're making a law, now they have to take the language of the law as it is. And then whatever changes they're making within that law, it needs to be basically a red line, right? So that you can mm-hmm. see the whole bill mm-hmm. in its context, and mm-hmm. then you can see how that changes. So mm-hmm. these bills are so complex. And when you're reading one bill, let's say you're reading 48-20-107, and you're in the middle of the bill, and it'll say blah, 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 except as it appears in, you know, 29-13-204, right? and so it's totally like reading a different language.
Right.
It's like reading a different language. So when he said that to me, what that meant to me was they were basically creating a new Christmas tree. Right. So they can go back and put an ornament over here and an ornament. Right. Over here. And my big statement over and over and over is about the private contractors, contractors, yeah. You know, it's so rampant in the Department of Children's Services. I stopped counting at 185 private contractors.
Mm-hmm. And, wow.
Yeah. And it's big. It's millions of dollars. I mean, DCS is 1.4 billion now. I know education is much larger than that, but just mm-hmm. imagine
yep.
what the feast it's going to provide for private contractors.
Yeah.
And there's no, and the problem, you know, we think, you know, there is this belief on the conservative side that private business can do it better than the government. Okay. We kind of have this general belief, well, you know, we can do it. Private enterprise can do it better than government. Okay. But here's what's happened. When you have private contractors contract with the state agency, there's never any oversight. All right. Now, my family was in the restaurant business mm-hmm. for 30 years. When somebody walked out that door after they finished their meal, we knew whether we would ever see them again or not, right? If they were unhappy, they didn't like the food, they wanted to complain and didn't want to pay, they got to deal with us right then and there.
Right.
But mm-hmm. when you have people who are private contractors for government services,
mm-hmm.
and
yep.
CEOs for government services, there is no transparency, there right. is no oversight, there mm-hmm. is no accountability, yeah. and there is no sort of customer service resource or feedback. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And taxation without representation.
Right. And a really good example is the foster care model, because now so mm-hmm. much of the foster care is in private enterprise. And so, mm-hmm. right. and so what happens is if a child is abused in foster care, and I want you to just think of this, and then you can relate this to sort of this education and where education is going as well, because although it says choice, I don't think it will always be choice as we right. go forward. It will be what is available and what, where you can go, and here's your options. Right.
Mm-hmm. So,
but like in foster care, if a child is harmed in foster care and you try to sue the foster care company, even like I did this, there's a foster care company called Keys. And mm-hmm. I tried to sue Keys because the children were abused and neglected in foster care. And mm-hmm. and what they have done is set up a private contractor relationship mm-hmm. with the foster parent. Mm-hmm. And so therefore they had no accountability. So let's just mm-hmm. transfer that to education. Let's yeah. say we have a national organization that's going, wants to put in, you know, these pockets for school choice to grab this money up in Tennessee. But let's right. say they technically like franchise it or something, mm-hmm. right? Which they can be able to do. Mm-hmm. So sure. then we'll have, yeah. So then you'll yeah, have a Maximus. Oh my gosh.
I was just thinking about Maximus. And yeah. pulled it up. Yeah.
So then you'll have, if something happens to the child at school, there's mm-hmm. not going to be any ability to get accountability for that. And there's right. no transparency. You can't see when you have private contractors doing government mm-hmm. work, there's no transparency. You would have right. thought we would have learned our lesson. We've screwed up the whole entire prison system. We've screwed yeah. up the whole war machine, all of our military, screwed up foster care, and now this. So this is where yeah. we are. Okay.
Yeah, and there's going to be a huge cottage industry of PPPs, which is what Connie's talking about. Yeah. We talked about before.
Sure.
The public-private partnerships from therapy services. Well, that alone should scare every parent on the face of this planet.
Right.
That these therapy services are going to be partnered with the state to provide therapy services for children. They're going to be private businesses, and they're going to be funded via taxpayers' dollars. And that's just one of the many uniforms, transportation, right. curriculum. You know, the list just goes on and on. After school programs, enrichment opportunities. I mean, it's just a major right. Trojan horse. And then who, you know, we're going to have a whole nother separate branch of government
mm-hmm.
to monitor all of this of to course. Make sure that, you know, it's being utilized correctly and, right. and, you know, administered correctly. And I say that tongue in cheek because it hasn't been utilized or administered correctly in other states. And we'll get to that later, but sure. I agree with Connie.
But they need a whole infrastructure yes. to do that. And that will be another
yeah,
government expense, of course, mm-hmm. at the taxpayers' expense.
Exactly.
All right. Shall we move on?
Is if you're a private school, you have to be in existence for 3 years, unless you're a Category 1, which means that you're approved by the Department of Education and you operate as closely to a public school as humanly possible for a private school.
Yes. So yeah. this is one that that really concerns me yeah. with this. There are a lot of categories that are labeled as non-public schools.
Right.
And so this particular category is a Category 1 school. And I actually have something that I want to read from okay. the Department of Education about what they say about these Category 1 schools.
Okay.
So schools in Category 1 are approved through direct application to the Tennessee Department of Education through the open application window each year from January through May. Schools that provide education to students receiving short-term medical or transient care are classified under this category as Category 1 special purpose schools. So then you get into what exactly does transient care mean? Mm-hmm. What types of children are attending these schools? And I actually mm-hmm. looked on the Department of Tennessee's website to pull up the names of some mm-hmm. of these Category 1 schools. And it seems that some of them have medical conditions so they're receiving special services at these schools for those particular medical conditions. Hard of hearing, cochlear implants was one specifically that I pulled up. There are some that target the pre-K and the kindergarten classroom. There are some Montessori schools that are listed there as well. And I'm going to be doing a deep dive on this and releasing some information about this. But what concerns me is that now schools can bill, like I said earlier, for Medicaid without parental consent. So I see this as a huge problem. What yeah. about you, Connie?
Yeah. So this category of special purpose schools, you know, again, I'm going to kind of go into the undocumented children, mm-hmm. which is
yeah.
going crazy right now. And
mm-hmm.
and I just found out today that the Department of Children's Services had just entered an agreement in a federal case, which means our attorney general just entered an agreement in this case where they agree to provide these children services mm-hmm. until they're age 24. And then somebody, one of my connections who's actually does some foster care work, she says that the undocumented children are going through what are called special purpose schools. So I think that is, you know, it says that they're non-public and as close mm-hmm. to education, but clearly this is another place that the mm-hmm. taxpayer dollars are going where there's no transparency mm-hmm. and we don't really know what they are.
Yeah. And, you know, the funny thing about it is that if these, like you just said, if these schools are eligible for this voucher funding, who are the children in these schools? What population of children are these schools serving? And again, I keep going back to the at-risk categories, you know, that the state earmarked back when we were dealing with the at-risk boarding charter facilities.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that this also includes the juvenile detention kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're waived. Like, they don't have to be in existence for 3 years in order to utilize these funds, like another non-public school that would be applying for the voucher program would have to do.
Wow.
So that one, I think, is just a huge Trojan horse right there.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, I'd say.
Yeah.
All right. Next
question. And I will say, you know, and I know that this is going to be a little bit off from what you're talking about, but we do have some good protections in the bill on teachers that have high evaluations, not having to have evaluations as frequently.
Okay. Yeah, this is the
And this one goes back to they're trying to placate the public school teachers to get them to support this piece of legislation and to have their legislators that are in their district to vote for a bill that has some things embedded in it that they would perceive as positive for the public school system. Right.
Yeah, I would say I don't know what this has to do with school choice at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Doesn't seem to have anything to do with school choice.
Mm-mm.
All right. Next.
Fraud provision, that came from me. I mean, I talked to him last week at length about it, or 2 weeks ago at length about having need to have fraud. I actually would have made it a felony, but they told me they'd have to go into change another part of the code. And I'm like, all right. But I would make it a felony if they commit fraud because I can tell you firsthand from Florida, there were people that hundreds of thousands of dollars they stole. So, and then you've had Arizona and you've also had Ohio just recently get caught up in scandal. So,
so okay. Referencing like the money. Okay. Yeah. You go on. Yeah.
Okay, so this is like, okay, so it's fraught with all kinds of problems. And this also gets back to what I said a minute ago. You read the code in 68, you know, 42-101, and it says, you know, that it might otherwise be considered, you know, might otherwise be prosecuted under Title 39-17-406-B1, right? And so, and here's, they don't resolve that question, right? Because he says specifically, he was told they would have to change another part of the code. Mm-hmm. So, which means, because there's a criminal code. So criminal, Tennessee loves to create crimes, but most of the crimes are defined in under Title 39.
I know we want to eradicate crime, not create crimes. Like, yeah.
No, they want more criminals. They want more criminal. I mean, this is a little off the bunny trail a little bit, but I'm just going to tell you anyway, they have a crime now that if a woman gets pregnant and has a baby and she claims somebody is the daddy and he's not the daddy, it's a crime. Okay. She can go to jail for that. Now I'm like, look, this is 2022. We have DNA. I mean, this is not a question, right? But they actually made it criminal. It's criminal. So, there's a whole bunch of more like that. They keep sneaking in and they've snuck in four or five more this year. Mm-hmm. But he says, basically, he just really admitted there's no oversight included. There's no oversight provision. There's no report. He didn't even talk about any reporting requirements, any auditing requirements. I mean, even just the basics. And he goes, oh, because another part of the code would have to be changed. So, and then he starts naming all the places where obviously they didn't figure out how to fix that or stop that in advance. Ohio, Arizona, Florida, and they've had these big problems. So, you know, that should be like, I see that like flashing lights. Like,
right. Yeah. Exactly.
You already know that. Why aren't you looking at what you need to do before you start that process?
Exactly. Right. And this isn't anything new either. I mean, they've been wanting to implement this for a long time in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. one would have thought that all of those safeguards would, you know, have already been discussed and what a good program would look like. And, you know, I think parents need to realize, again, they're not just going to give you money for you to do with as you wish. You will be audited. You know, you will have to prove to the state that you are using these funds if you choose to take them legally. And if the state deems that you are not using them legally, then you can be criminally prosecuted. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that happens. I've seen this in other states that have already adopted universal school choice. Right. There will be accountability attached to this money. So, you know, you're not going to get $7,000 to go take a Disney World vacation.
Right.
You know, you're not going to get $7,000 to be able to put a pool in your backyard.
Right.
It would probably not be a very nice pool, but you get what I'm saying.
Right, right.
I mean, you're not going to be able to spend the money on what you would like to spend the money right. on just at will. There's going to be, in some states, they even require you to pay up front and then submit reimbursement, you know, paperwork. Mm-hmm. And then if they determine that those expenses are eligible for reimbursement, then they mm-hmm. will reimburse you. Right. And so it just goes on and on and on. But the narrative that this does not come with strings is just erroneously false. I mean, it is right. not. That's not true. I mean, I'm sorry, but if someone is auditing me, I would consider that a string.
Yeah, well, yeah, a pretty invasive string.
Yeah.
I would also just add with the whole point that you made about the public-private partnership, uh-huh. then, you know, it sounds like not only do you not have the, you know, ability to use the money at will, but mm-hmm. you might not even within things that are within their parameters, mm-hmm. you might not be able to have any choice of, like, let's say it's uniform, for instance, you
right.
know, of where you go for your yeah. supplies.
It'll have to be from that vendor
exactly.
that has been approved by the state. Same thing with therapy services, which, again, I cannot highlight that enough.
Yeah.
That the therapy that your child would be receiving would have to be approved via the state.
Yeah.
That's concerning.
That's very mm-hmm. concerning.
Well, and so just for some clarity,
yeah.
I mean, Tiffany's talking about the oversight and the overshadowing mm-hmm. upon the parent, but on the mm-hmm. other side of that, the private contractors who just say, you know, just give us a $7,000 and we're going to educate your child. That's what they're arguing about, is they've seen all types of frauds in different
yep,
states
right.
with mm-hmm. no accountability and no, mm-hmm. no criminal, you know, prosecution. So, mm-hmm. and this is generally, you know, one of the complaints I have about, you know, with CPS, you know, they complain if a child is, you know, they don't eat the proper food or the house is dirty or whatever, but the same thing happens in the foster homes mm-hmm. and nobody, the parents never get to complain that the foster home is not treating my child properly. So,
mm-hmm. right.
you know, it's the way it works is so
yes.
dysfunctional.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
The Next. Other aspects, what we say, it's $7,075 on the scholarship. It can be used for certain things. We have put in safeguards, making it a Class A misdemeanor for fraud and other things or misusage, making sure that we don't have rampant fraud that's going on, whether it's the operator of the system or whether it's parents of that. And the last thing that we did is we removed homeschoolers out from the House version. It's still in the Senate. And so it does not apply to homeschoolers anymore, because there was a fear that they would just simply leave and go to a homeschool and they would never teach their child and they would just take the money. And so we exempted out homeschoolers, so they're no longer part of the House version on the choice side.
Okay, I got to tell everybody something right now.
All right.
If you've not watched the House and Senate floor, okay, this is what happens. First of all, it sounds like you're in an auctioneer's barn, okay, mm-hmm. the way they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a caller, and it's so annoying, the whole thing, the whole process. Okay, he said something here that's really triggering. So he said, the homeschoolers are still in the Senate bill. They're not in the House bill. The Senate has already passed their bill, right, Tiffany? Right.
It goes to committee this week. It goes to the Senate Finance Ways and Means Committee on Tuesday.
But did it already pass one committee?
Yes, it already passed out of the last committee, and now it's on to the Finance, Ways, and Means.
Okay, so it'll probably pass there, all right, because they've already got the votes. Remember what they said at the end of the thing there. All right, so we have the homeschoolers and the Senate bill out of the House bill. So if it gets to the floor like this, they will go to the House floor, and Lamberth will stand up and say he wants to adopt and conform to the Senate bill. Okay, do you get it? Do you see how this happens?
Yes, and I'll say this, they're not out of the House bill. There has been mass confusion, and I think on the part of the taxpayers. I think they, this is my opinion, know exactly what they're doing. Independent homeschoolers were never included in this legislation to begin with. So when they're referring to homeschoolers, that's who they're referring to.
Yeah.
Homeschoolers that fall under Category 4, and by the way, that is the majority of the homeschool population in the state of Tennessee, are still included in the House version of this bill. What they're referring to is the A1, and what we are is number 3. So Category 4 church-related schools are still included in the House version of this bill as we are sitting here today. So that's just a play on words, in my opinion. Now, Scott Sapicki had sent out an amendment that he was telling everyone that would write homeschoolers out of this bill. That amendment was never filed. So the wording with the House bill right now still includes Category 4 homeschoolers, which is the majority of the homeschool population in the state of Tennessee. So again, they're still beating this drum that homeschoolers have been removed from the House version. The largest majority of homeschoolers in the state of Tennessee have not. And then additionally, for him to say the whole reason they took homeschoolers out in the first place was they didn't want them to take the money and then go and not teach their children anything. So, you know, what a terrible statement to make regarding the homeschool community at large, you know, from, was that Speaker Sexton speaking there that that made that accusation? I mean, not because you care about freedom and you value the fact that homeschoolers want to be left out of this because we understand what the government funds it runs, but because you think that homeschoolers would use the money fraudulently by taking the money and not educating their children.
Right, right. Yeah, and now so here he said, and here he said that he talked about crimes, right? He said, now we're gonna make the fraud a Class A misdemeanor. Okay, so I don't know how that law is going to be defined, but what I suspect is it's going to be general and vague enough so that they can pick and choose what fraud is, right?
That's what I was wondering.
So is it fraud if your child wants to take karate and that you incorporate that somehow into your education and you want to use the money for that? Is it now fraud to use the money for that because they can say that's not educational, or whether it's a field trip, or you know, what is fraud? What is fraud?
Right. I mean,
fraud is supposed to be, fraud is supposed to be something that is just so I want to say fraudulent, right? Because that's the way you think about it. But but fraud is supposed to be very, very serious. So, you know, I don't know.
It's misrepresentation, but yes, on a grand scale.
I think another thing that really concerns me is I don't think the general public realizes how much authority the Department of Education, the State Board of Education has. Lizette Gonzalez Reynolds, our commissioner, and I did a live over on the Free Your Children Facebook page several days ago where I tried to connect the dots for people that were asking lots of questions. And I said, they have made it clear from the House hearing committee meetings and the Senate committee meetings that I've sat through, it has been made abundantly clear that the way this is going to work is the State Board of Education has the authority to promulgate the rules, meaning make the rules regarding how this program is going to be administered and how the funds are going to be distributed. And so when some of our legislators were asking questions about specific administration of this program, she said, she made the statement, Once this passes into law, then we will make the rules. So we will pass it into law and then decide what rules we're going to make that the public is then going to have to abide by.
That's convenient.
Yeah.
Very convenient. Yes.
Well, and let me, so people kind of understand that, how that works as well. So we have the legislator writing the laws, the code, the green books, right? Like the code 6817-101, right? And then, and remember, we have 40 agencies. We have 270 commissions, okay, in the state of Tennessee. So every single agency has the ability to write its own regulations. Now, the regulations are supposed to be approved by the General Assembly, but then they also have the right to write their own policy, which is never approved or reviewed by any other branch of government. So, so that is correct. And that's one of the problems that happens is you have, and, you know, again, I'm, you know, I know Tiffany's an education expert. I'm the CPS expert. So, but there's so much crossover because they both deal with families and children, but like in the CPS, where a family is accused, let's say, of educational neglect, and they take their children in a courtroom, they have to meet a really high burden of proof, which is called clear and convincing evidence. But the agency can substantiate educational neglect on a preponderance of evidence. And they don't, the parents don't even really get due process in that place. So, so regulations are very, very, very dangerous. I went to a regulations meeting this summer. I spoke at it, but they are, and most people don't even think about it. Attorneys don't even think about it, you know, when they're going to court and trying to represent and work with somebody in one of these areas, whether it's education or CPS or healthcare or whatever.
Yeah, it's problematic. And I think that that's exactly what happened over the summer when the State Board of Education promulgated rules that affected the homeschool community at large, not just the homeschool community, but Category 4 schools. Right. And, you know, that's private schools, you know, that's non-public schools, church-related schools, homeschools. And everyone was wondering how that happened and what gave them the authority to do that. And Connie just outlined for you exactly what gave them the authority to do that. And that's how they're, that's what's going to happen with this program, too, if it passes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's scary. All right. Shall we move on to the next one? This, I wish this were cheery, but you know, it seems to be more and more discouraging as we go along. But here we are.
We've had conversations and look, you know, I mean, I would sit here and say, you know, if someone wants to say, well, I could be for this if we put $10,000 in instead of $7,000, we can have that conversation. No one's making the argument that I'm for it if we put in 10 or 11 or whatever amount. It's more of a, they throw it out, but they're still against it. And we're willing to have the conversations if we want to increase that amount. But we're, right now we're at 7,000.
This one kills me. this one really kills me. Yeah, I mean, why would you make it like 100,000 a kid, you know? Yeah.
They seem to have no problem spending our money, right?
No. Well, I mean, I was floored just in the subcommittee meeting we went to that it was overnight. It went from $140 billion, billion dollars to a million. Is that $140 million? Okay, sorry. $140 million to $460 million. It's still a lot of money, but I mean, it may as well be billion, trillion. They just don't seem to have any concept.
Well, and if you look at the actual 39-page amendment, this House amendment that they're talking about in this call, there are all kinds of unknowns regarding how much this is going to cost. It says that, you know, in the fine print. And so all of these are just projections.
Right.
And then as more and more families, if this does pass into law, buy into this, it's going to cost the state even more money.
Right.
That, well, I shouldn't say the state, it's going to cost the taxpayers even more and more money to be able to expand this program. And that's the goal. It's to expand it. It's not to stop with the 20,000. It's not to stop with the next however many thousand. It's to make it available to any student who is eligible to attend a public school in the state of Tennessee.
Yeah. And I don't know where the 7,000 came from in the first place. What's the formula for that? Like, does anybody, do you know, Tiffany?
I think that, well, the TISA formula in general is so convoluted. I mean, you would, there's people that are tasked with implementing that formula that do not even understand it because it's so convoluted. And so they discussed in the call a lot about the TISA formula, and the person that was asking the question in this call, they specifically said the math isn't mathing. I mean, that's not what they, that's not the terminology they use.
Yeah.
But that is exactly what they meant, is they don't understand. They weren't understanding how they derived that particular figure. And again, Courtney's going to drop the link where people can go back and listen to the entire call in its entirety. Cause we're just, we don't have time to discuss every single aspect of this, but that's a good question, Connie. I have no idea how they arrived at that. I think what he was saying in the call is that they looked at the overall cost of private schools. Mm-hmm. And so they settled on that particular amount of money because of the how much private schools cost across the state.
Well,
and that was an average.
Yeah. And that doesn't seem to be it either. Cause I heard that part of the conversation and somebody asked him, well, you know, school can cost $28,000 and $28,000. And, and then he goes, well, the average across the state is 11,000. Right. So, I mean, if it's 11,000, the 7,000 doesn't cut it. I haven't heard anybody say, this is the value we place on a kid's head to educate them. I haven't heard anybody say that. And I know, you know, when you just put up there on the screen about Arizona, it exploded. If they have a dollar amount in the code and they, it will go up. They will, all they have to do is a one line law next year and it'll be 8,500 and then it'll be 12,000. And then we'll just wonder where all that money's going.
Yeah. And let's point out, it's not their money. I mean, I highly doubt that these legislators up there that are making these laws, are they taking the money out of their account?
No.
It's taxpayers' dollars that, you know, are funding this. And of course, the state's not going to be able to keep up with this fiscally. So then what are they going to have to do to make sure that they cover these expenditures? They're going to raise taxes.
I want to throw another twist in there since we're talking money. Here's another little rabbit trail. Okay. So the, All right. So Tennessee, the Senate has already passed it. The House hasn't quite passed it yet, but they're trying to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot for the next governor's race to say that the state can use taxpayers' money to invest in the private stock market. Okay. So
what?
I
have to laugh because this just keeps getting better and better.
Yeah. So one day I was doing some of my random research, and actually a mutual friend of ours was on the phone with me, and she was doing some stuff, and she asked me this question about this. We were looking at bonus money. And there's a gentleman who works for the state of Tennessee. His last name is Brakeville. And he got a bonus of an annual bonus working for the state of Tennessee of $325,000, something like that. And so I'm like, who is this guy? So I started looking him up. And he is one of the people who manages the Tennessee State Retirement Fund, Employee Retirement Fund, whatever it's called. And they brought him in specifically to be able to invest in private equity. So the Tennessee Retirement Fund can invest in private equity. So this is just another step in that. But I did a study that started in 2009, and I pulled all the records from 2009 all the way up to 2022. And that private equity money has exploded. Okay. It's exploded. They get 25% return on money that they put into private equity. Now, the question is, what's private equity? Because private equity, the reason I went down that bunny hole is because I know they use private equity funds to create juvenile detention centers, the troubled teen industry, group homes for teenagers, mental health facilities. And so this will, this money is going to be dirty money so fast that we won't even be able to keep up with it.
Yeah. Just another level there of what we have going on here in Tennessee and why people need to get involved in what's going on and do their own research.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm sure it's not just Tennessee.
No, it's not. It's nationwide.
Yeah. This is disgusting. All right. Next.
Try to do small. We try to do sparse. And then the other thing, if you're interested, as far as the infrastructure, one of the things that TISA never provided was for maintenance or infrastructure across the state. And so what we've tried to do is put in a $75 per student amount. That's direct funding, which means the locals don't have to match it for every school district. So depending on how many students you have, you get $75 a person, which means that you could bond out off that money, which in some areas could be a lot. But it is a direct a funding to the district that would be a recurring basis.
So again, within what was supposed to be a school voucher bill, we're now discussing funding for maintenance and infrastructure.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. I'm just like,
I don't know what this has to do with vouchers at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's just more pork.
Right.
That they've put into the bill that, you know, taxpayers are going to be funding.
And so my question, Tiffany, was he was talking about local matching. Is the voucher money somehow have some local matching provision? What was he talking about there?
I'm not exactly sure of the specifics on the funding of how they're going to do it, because, you know, as I said before, do we really know what they're doing until they pass it? It looks like a whole Nancy Pelosi thing. But there's been a lot of discussion about funding for IDEA, you know, how those federal funds follow the child, and how a public school, this has nothing to do with the infrastructure that we were talking about. But that's just another level to this, saying that in certain instances, the money may stay with the student, or it may move to another district. These vouchers can be utilized for students that don't live. For instance, we live in one county. If I wanted to send my child, if they were in public school, to a neighboring county, then with this voucher program, you will be allowed to do that. So there's been a whole lot of discussion in the Senate hearings and the House hearings. Will that money stay in that district, or will it follow the child? So I think there's a lot of that in all different capacities of this bill, as far as who the money is going to stay with, where the money is going to go. You know, are these, I think with the infrastructure and the maintenance situation, is that there are already areas where we've had an influx of people move into our state. And so already they don't have enough schools. You know, they need more maintenance. They need more infrastructure money for this.
Right.
And then if you have parents who maybe live in a district that's not as wealthy, and they want to take their children and move to a wealthier district, then that puts another financial burden on that district, because then they're going to have someplace to put all these kids, right? And so I think that's what they're discussing about, you know, the $75 with the child is reoccurring, and then, you know, there's money with the infrastructure and money for the maintenance. And I think that that was one thing that they were trying to make the public schools feel good about, you know, that this would be funds that they would be able to utilize. And I don't know exactly how all that's going to work, or exactly where it's going to stay, and who's going to be, you know, putting what where. And I think that's one of the biggest problems, is even our legislators are asking these questions in the committees.
Right. Yeah. That's... Any other thoughts on that, or?
No. Okay.
All right.
You know, I just think it's important to note that it likely will cause a burden in districts that are known as being a really good district to educate kids. Because if we're talking about educational choice, which is what it's supposed to be about, isn't every parent going to want to send their child to the district that's known as having the best schools?
It's a great way to level the playing field, right? We just bring everybody down to the lowest denominator.
Yeah.
So, This way we don't have to worry about the competition.
Yeah, but as far as the funding, it's so convoluted.
Yeah.
You know, I need a flow chart, Connie. Maybe that'll, if I had a flow chart where I could actually look at exactly, you know, where this funding is coming from and if it was staying in one district, going to another district, you know, what was staying with the child, what was moving ahead. I mean, these are conversations.
Good luck getting that.
Yeah, that keep being heard in all of the committee meetings. And I think the legislators that I have seen anyway in the committees where I've been, they're trying to wrap their head around exactly how it's all supposed to work.
Yeah. And I will say one thing about the funding. I ask about how did they get the $7,000 and where did it come from? Right. And I was trying to figure out if somehow it was associated with the TISA funding. And you know, in the TISA funding, there's all these kind of little bonus check things, bonus money. And one of them is foster care. And and that's why I'm like, how did they get this? And what are going to be the add-ons to that? Because if a school has a foster child enrolled, they get 25% more for that child. Mm-hmm. So, which is So foster children are just, there's just the, you know, a price tag on their head all the way around. So, so if it is associated with TISA, I anticipate what's going to happen is if DCS has kids in foster care and somehow they're going to qualify for this voucher, or there's going to be voucher money, they're going to go in and say, well, we should get a 25% extra because under the TISA formula, we would be getting that extra money. So, so that's just, you know, that's why I was kind of like, where'd that money come from? Who
yeah. I will say where they're talking about, I pulled it up because I had some actual screenshots from the bill. And here's one avenue that was interesting to me that I wanted to point out. It said, if a student enrolling in the EFA program is in that's the Educational Freedom Scholarship Act, program is in a Title I LEA and attends a private school that participates in federal grants, the LEA's equitable services cost would increase for that student because the equitable services funds that LEAs, that's the local education agency, have to pass along is based on the number of students in private schools. And LEAs federal funding will not increase, so they will have to pay out more funding but not receive any additional funding. However, the amount of additional funding that will be passed along to private schools cannot be reasonably determined. So that was one thing that I wanted to definitely point out from the bill. And then this subsection here where it says other fiscal impact. If students enrolling in the program are part of a Title I local education agency and attend a private school that participates in federal grants, recurring local expenditures could increase by unknown amounts as a result of the Education Freedom Scholarship Program.
And so I have a question.
Yes.
If the child is pulled out of a public school and goes into this program, does the public school where they would be enrolled lose $7,000?
Well, the federal, that was the big debate in the Senate, because what they were saying is, I think there was a huge discussion regarding that. And it was hard to nail down exactly what they were saying and hard to follow. And so what I heard, and I could be wrong, so if you know this or if anyone else knows this, they can weigh in. It looked as if that funding was going to go with the child. Were you asking about another public school or a private school, Connie?
Well, if they're in public school.
Yes.
And they go into the Educational Freedom Act program.
The voucher.
Mm-hmm. And they're out of the public school. Does that public school lose that $7,000?
That's a good question.
Yeah,
I think that they would. If the student is in the IDEA program, which is, you know, if they're in public school, it's called Title I money, and they have an IEP. And then if they leave and navigate out of the public school system, you can't take an IEP out of the public school system. So then it's called, you know, it's the IDEA funding that follows the child. And that private school has to provide equitable services. So I think that's what they're discussing, you know, with this as well. But I would not imagine that a local public school would still be able to receive funding on a child that was no longer in their system.
Right.
But that's a good question. So then it goes on to say, it is unknown what actions LEAs will take as a result of the proposed change to the state share of basic health plan premiums for LEA employees. Should LEAs keep the estimated LEA employee share the same, there will be a significant increase in funds available for LEAs to spend. For the fiscal year 24-25, the change in LEA share would result in an additional $160.4 million statewide. Then it goes on to talk about if the COT audits the reimbursement program for teacher child care, the cost for the audit will be borne by local governments. However, due to multiple unknown variables affecting the cost of any future audit, a precise permissive increase in local expenditures cannot be reasonably determined. The governor's proposed fiscal year 24-25 proposed budget includes $144,200,000 in recurring funds for the Education Freedom Scholarship implementation.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, you know, there are a lot of unknowns as far as what it's going to wind up, you know, costing. And there's still confusion, in my opinion, as to, you know, where money's going to stay, where it's going to go. You know,
it sounds like that's intentional.
Yeah.
I mean, they want to keep it very vague. So they have lots of leeway to then.
And I don't have the entire bill in front of me, but that bill is uploaded to my website at freeyourchildren.com. There's a section that says Tennessee voucher bill or voucher legislation. You can click on that for more information, and you can access the Senate version. You can access the House version. You can see the amendments there. So, you know, if you want to read it for yourself, and I highly encourage everyone to do that. Yeah, it's the Tennessee voucher bill that you see up on the screen. If you click on the Learn More tab right there, it will take you to a page where you can access these bills and, again, read them for yourself. Now, I'll just go ahead and tell you, they're going to change.
Right, right.
This is going to continually change, and we'll do our best to keep the website updated with the current information. But these bills go to committees on Monday. Monday, it's a joint committee. It's government ops. So it's a joint committee with representatives and senators. And I have those representatives and senators that you can contact and tell them to vote no if you don't agree with this bill. And then, of course, on Tuesday, it goes back to the Senate for the Finance, Ways, and Means. And we do have events scheduled with Free Your Children where we will be there in opposition to this particular piece of legislation.
Okay. All right. Shall we put up? I think we have two more.
And also the insurance difference. You know, we've for years been trying to get the state insurance. Right now, it's $45.55 for teachers on the state insurance match. This bill that we have ups that to 60% on the state share, and so that's a significant savings of 15% that goes directly to teachers in a lot of respects that are in areas that that are strictly 45-55 split on their insurance. And for the school systems that do have a local match in there, then that's a 15% savings that is freeing up money that will stay in education. And so we ran the numbers on some of that. You know, on the ones that are getting that 15% straight to the teachers, that's somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,000 to $2,000 that's going to be a direct savings to our teachers by going up to that 15% on the state share side of insurance. So I just want to make sure we threw that in there too. Yeah.
Okay. That doesn't have anything to do with school choice, I would say. That's more benefits. That's more money, more taxpayer money.
Right.
And I don't know how that compares to other state employees. So I can't comment about it too much, except to say that that's not really what everybody
does. Right. Exactly. And again, I'll tell people, go watch these committee hearings for yourself.
Right.
You know, don't leave here today and take what we're saying as, you know, how you should make a determination based off this call or even based off of what's happening in the House and Senate. go and listen for yourself, you know, and hear what your legislators have to say as they're going through the process and this bill is moving through the committees.
Absolutely. All right. Shall we play the last one?
Yes, this is Jeff Luttrell, Director of Wills County Schools. And of course, when the House amendments hit, it's obvious there's a lot in there that we welcome in public schools. We've been asking for. So my question is, why does the changes that are good for public schools have to be tied to a choice bill? Why couldn't they stand alone and push those through General Assembly when you have a supermajority?
Well, I think from our standpoint is even when some of these things in the bill that we have been tried to be passed for years and you couldn't.
I think that says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, wow. Yeah.
I wonder what that is, though. Do you know? When he says some of these things we've been trying to pass for years,
right? And
what is that?
I don't know. I would just assumed, and you know, you shouldn't assume, but I'm just saying from the phone call, you know, listening to the entire call, I think that they were talking about the good portions of the bill that have been added to benefit public schools. And so I was just under the assumption that he was referring to, we've tried to do this before, you know, as far as get more money, you know, for teachers in terms of offsetting the cost of their insurance or, you know, maintenance and infrastructure for schools, or what were some of the lowering the number of teacher evaluations, you know, the things that are in the bill now is I'm assuming what he was referring to. But that's a good question, Connie, because has there been pieces of legislation filed in the past with those particular talking points that have been defeated?
Yeah, I don't think from what he says we can even tell. Right. I mean, when I listen to this, one of the things that, you know, I don't think they had very good questioners on the call, right? Like, you know, can you go a little bit deeper into that? Because I want to know, what are we doing? What are we doing that didn't pass before? I mean, we've had a red supermajority for several years now. So what is it that's in this bill that you couldn't get passed unless you renamed it, right? Unless you repackaged it. So that's
I mean, I think he said it all when he said, we like the things that are in here that are good for public schools.
Yeah.
But why does it have to be attached to a school choice bill? I was glad he brought that out, actually. Yeah,
definitely.
Right.
It should be a separate bill. I don't know why all of these things get lumped together. Mm-hmm. Like, just an excuse to kind of hide them. And
And I think a huge concern for the public schools is that once kids come out of public schools to go into private schools, whether it be homeschools or whether it be, you know, traditional brick and mortar private schools to utilize these voucher funding, you know, how catastrophic is that going to be for the public school system in terms of loss of revenue, you know, in terms of just, you know, I say this all the time. There's no competition when the government controls all the competition. So on the one hand, you know, they're trying to give these things to teachers to placate them, but then they're offering, you know, dangling this money carrot to parents to remove their children from public schools. Yeah. So it the irony in this is not lost, I don't think.
No, not at all. Yeah, totally.
I would agree. Well, I don't know if either of you have any closing things you want to say. Well, definitely thanks to Patriot Punk for recording that for us. Then we just took out clips, but he has the whole thing up on his. So we'll post the link for that if you want to listen to the rest of it, which I highly recommend you do. You know, we just took out some segments that we thought were, you know, good talking points to discuss. And I recommend you go and look at it. And of course, go look at the bill and make your own decisions, but definitely get involved, because this is not just about education. It's bad enough that it's about education, but as you can see, they're trying to tie all these other things to it, and a lot of money.
Yep, a lot of money.
Yeah, and you know, and I would say, yes, we do need voices. We need support. You know, you can find me just, you know, Facebook's probably the most active. A lot of people just watch what I say on TikTok. I do mm-hmm. put up videos on YouTube, like particularly if I have gone to speak at a general assembly, I go back, capture it, re-upload it. I'm a little bit behind, but mm-hmm. so that people can see what's going on. They can just find me under my name on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I also have a grassroots organization called the Family Forward Project. That is primarily families who've been affected, families, grandparents, extended relatives become affected by CPS. On LinkedIn, if anybody's involved in LinkedIn, we do have now, I have found that LinkedIn is, we're getting more professionals who are talking about some of these issues at a higher level. I mean, sort of cross-professional. So we have, you know, college professors and, you know, publishers and, you know, I'm enjoying that platform because we can join the voices that way, but those are nationwide. Those are people from all over. Sure. So, you know, if you are in Tennessee and I have people all over the country watching Tennessee, as yeah. I'm sure Tiffany does. And mm-hmm. if you are in Tennessee, look at the little bit that you can do to mm-hmm. help Tiffany and me. And she goes up there. I've taken some families up there. I'm trying to get some young people to go up there next week who've experienced the system. And just, you know, you only get 3 minutes to talk. So you can, you know, if you need help preparing a speech, you can get some help doing that. And that's not a problem because it's only 3 minutes is only about 300 words anyway. So it doesn't take long to write that up for somebody. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of a pain going down there. I am going to say, I'm just going to tell people right away when I go yep. down there, I park at the courthouse because you can park underground. You don't have to put an app on your phone. It's the most reasonably priced. It's about a 4-block walk over past the bus station to get over to the General Assembly. Hey, can mm-hmm. you guys pull up the, can you pull up like a little Google map or something so we can show people where it is right there? The Cordell Hall building. Mm-hmm. So people can get an idea of where it is in downtown Nashville. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a pain, but
it's a pain.
It's you know, you walk the halls, you see the people, they need to see our faces.
Absolutely.
I agree.
I will say, Connie, I agree with that. Phone calls are great. You know, emails are great, but mm-hmm. there's no substitute mm-hmm. for them to have to look in the faces right. of the people that this legislation that they're voting on is going to affect. Yeah. So I think it shocked them when we showed up with a mm-hmm. large group, yeah. you know, in the House and the Senate. I don't think that they were expecting that. And I do think that people need to be mindful of how powerful that is. I Absolutely. Really do.
Yeah. And it's so funny because they refuse to pronounce my name correctly every time I go down there. Okay. So this is very good. Yeah. So the red, and if people take a look at that, so you come across the river, you can mm-hmm. come across the Nashville Public Square parking. You come across on, I usually cross on the big bridge there that appears kind of a light color. You can zoom back into that. Zoom back in. Oh, no, in, not out. Yep. Mm-hmm. And so where that white bridge is, what's it called? James Robertson Parkway off of I-24 around Nashville, I-40 around Nashville. As soon as you cross that bridge, right after you cross that bridge, there is a public parking underground. You have to jump. I mean, it's you don't even if you don't know it's there. The first time you'll probably miss it and drive past the courthouse, but you can, and it's, you see where that little green thing is. It says Nashville Public Square Park. That is actually the entrance to that is on James Robertson Parkway, and just zip down there and then walk about 4 blocks over there. It's not a hard walk. That's where I always park and just come. And if you know, are interested in coming, I know, I think Tiffany said you were going to be there on Monday. I'm going to be there on Tuesday for sure.
I'll be there both days. I'll be there Monday and Tuesday of next week.
Oh, great. So, yeah. So where do we find you?
You can find me at freeyourchildren.com. You can find me there. You can find me on Rumble. We just, like Connie, we started a new Rumble channel to be able to share some clips of, you know, my testimony and some other things that we think are really important. Mm-hmm. You can find me over at the Borough Pulse, BoroughPulse.com. And I'm on all social media platforms, I believe now at this point, under Free Your Children. So you can look for me there.
Great. And
good. And we thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you both for all the work you're both doing and really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us, Courtney. You too.
Thank you. And thank you all for watching and listening.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.